told me. His wife had deliberated. That explained the uneventful Monday and Tuesday. Von Essen hadn't known right away. Angelo wondered why the woman had waited at all. He wondered if Von Essen had punished her for it. He imagined so.
I did some checking up on you, Father Bianco. You came to Italy when you were young, and when you weren't in school you lived with your grandparents. Your grandparents were live-in employees for a Jewish family, a family by the name of Rosselli. I was convinced you were also a Jew disguising yourself as a priest. But no, you are truly a Roman Catholic priest, ordained to the Roman diocese, a servant of God and Pope Pius XII, and a rising star at the Curia. You are authentic. It is Eva who is not. And she is not your sister, though it seems you were raised together.
When Angelo didn't protest or respond at all, but sat frozen in his seat, the captain laughed. It was an ugly laugh, devoid of humor or joy. It was a taunt, a repudiation.
I imagine you do love her, though I don't think you love her like a sister. In fact, I think you are sleeping with her.
She is too beautiful to resist, isn't she? I have hardly been able to keep my hands off her myself, but still, such unpriestly behavior. Von Essen shook his head and wagged his finger, as if he could hardly imagine such a thing. I am sure she has been helping you, sharing information with you. She must have overheard something about the raids last weekend. Or maybe that is my fault. I wanted her to be out of harm's way. And she betrayed me. The flash of rage again, this time not so well hidden. He leaned over the interview table, his eyes sharp and his voice soft.
But I will make you a deal, Father. I will let Eva go. I like the girl. And I don't want to see her tortured all because of you. So I will let Eva go, give her a head start, a chance to hide before we come after her, so to speak. But I need to know where you are hiding all your Jews. We will find them, you know. Every monastery, every convent, every school, every church, every religious college. We will raid them all again, one by one, and we will find them anyway. Your telling us where they are won't change their fate. But it might change Eva's.
Angelo's mind raced, pinging from one option to another and dismissing it almost immediately. Had the captain hurt Eva? Was she in a cell at this moment, awaiting deportation? Was she even at Via Tasso? His breaths grew shallow and his hands clenched. He didn't know it was possible to hate the way he did in that moment. The hate was so sharp it hurt, so bitter he could taste it on his tongue, so hot he could feel the flames in his chest. Angelo didn't close his eyes or bow his head, but he began to pray inwardly, searching for faith and strength. He ignored the captain. The soldiers standing outside the door with guns and helmets, empowered by evil men, and he pleaded for help. Prayer was the only weapon at his disposal. The captain leaned back, but he continued his negotiations.
10. Let's start with 10. 10 Jews for Eva. 10 for one. Isn't that the rule? I need 10 addresses.
He handed Angelo a pencil and a sheet of paper.
Or just the names, Father. Just the names of the establishments, and I will place Eva in your care. You give me the list, and you take your sister, and walk away. Only you and I will know. Eva might guess, but she will be grateful that you put her first, that you value her life above all others.
I don't have any information for you, Captain. I'm afraid I cannot help you.
Angelo answered firmly and without hesitation, not allowing himself to think at all.
No, not even for your sister's life.
Von Essen again put exaggerated emphasis on the word sister. I will be sure and tell her.
He stared at Angelo for a moment, as if gauging his next move.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. O, my Jesus, forgive us our sins, save us from the fires of hell, and lead all souls to heaven, especially those most in need of your mercy. Amen.
The rosary continued through his head like a desperate drumbeat, and Angelo begged Eva for forgiveness, even as he prayed that she would be saved from the fires of hell. He would happily give his life for hers, but he couldn't betray those in his care, and he knew Eva wouldn't want him to. Captain von Essen stood and leaned out the door.
"Bring the girl in,"
he said to the nearest guard. Angelo stood as well.
"Sit down, father. I have not had you restrained out of courtesy, but I will if I need to."
Angelo remained standing. The captain moved in closer, his hands clasped behind his back, his favorite pose.
"The men are all talking about her, father. How beautiful she is. She won't fare well here. You know that, don't you? And she won't fare well in a camp. But no one really fares well in the camps."
"May God have mercy on your soul,"
Angelo murmured, not trusting himself beyond a whisper. His hands ached with the need to close them around the sneering captain's neck.
"She won't be raped. Not here, at least. Do you know it is illegal for a German to lay with a Jew? Don't want to sully the bloodlines. We have higher standards than that."
"Oh, my Jesus, forgive us our sins, save us from the fires of hell, and lead all souls to heaven, especially those most in need of your mercy. Amen."
Angelo prayed out loud, his eyes locked with the captain's. He repeated the prayer again, enunciating the plea for those most in need of mercy. The door opened, and a helmeted German pushed Eva into the room, as if shoving and intimidation were part of the routine. Her eyes were wide and her face pale and frightened, but her hair was neat and her clothes tidy, and she appeared unharmed.
"Sit,"
the captain commanded, and Eva was pushed into a chair, the German soldier standing guard behind her.
"Sit,"
he commanded Angelo, and this time Angelo did as he was told, his eyes clinging to Eva's. Captain von Essen sat on a chair, triangulated between them, as if preparing to pit them against each other.
"I have no desire for unpleasantness. My wife is very fond of you, Eva, and she is quite beside herself over all of this."
Eva pulled her gaze from Angelo and stared at the captain stonily, waiting. The captain glared back, as if she had betrayed him personally. Then he continued.
"I have told Father Bianco that all he needs to do is tell me where the church is hiding the partisans and the Jews. Just 10. Not all. Just 10. But he says he can't help me. What do you think about that?"
Eva continued staring steadily at the captain. He raised a brow, waiting for her to respond. When she didn't, he leaned into her, as if confiding in her, and his voice lowered convincingly.
"You can save each other.
I have no desire to harm either of you. I just want to do my job. There is a great deal of pressure from Herr Himmler himself."
Captain von Essen took her hand.
"So why don't you tell me, Eva? Where is your brother hiding his Jews?"
"I am the only Jew he has helped, and that is only because we were raised together,"
Eva said steadily.
"You must be so very grateful,"
von Essen said softly. He pulled his weapon suddenly, and Eva gasped, but instead of firing it, he used it to backhand Angelo across the face. Angelo's head snapped back, and the left side of his face bloomed in hot pain,
but he almost laughed in relief. If this was the captain's approach, he welcomed it. Ask Ava the questions, torture Angelo. He wanted to sink to his knees in grateful prayer.
"You have me. Let him go,"
Ava cried. "Tell me what I want to know, and of course he may go."
"I am the only Jew he has helped," she repeated, her eyes closing, as if she couldn't watch what came next.
This time it was the right side of Angelo's face that took the brunt of the force.
"I am the only Jew Father Angelo has helped," Ava cried. "You have me. Let him go,"
she repeated, tears beginning to slide down her cheeks. Clearly, Captain von Essen thought she would be easier to break. Angelo knew differently. Ava wouldn't talk. She would suffer with him, but she wouldn't break.
"Where did you get your pass? It is very authentic."
Captain von Essen changed his line of questioning. Ava answered immediately, clearly relieved she could answer without endangering anyone.
"A man named Aldo Finzi. He worked for my father's company at one time, as a printer."
"A Jew?"
"Yes."
"And where can I find Mr. Finzi?"
"He is dead," Angelo cut into the conversation, pulling the captain's attention from Ava. The captain raised his brows disdainfully.
"How convenient,"
von Essen said dryly.
"I'm sure Aldo Finzi would disagree,"
Angelo shot back.
"And how did he die?"
"You shot him in the street a month ago near the rail station. Don't you remember?" Angelo challenged. He'd caught the captain by surprise, and von Essen tipped his head as if searching his memory.
"You shot him in the back of the head after you told him to drop his pants."
Captain von Essen looked stunned that Angelo knew the details. Had he felt so powerful, so invincible, that he hadn't really thought anyone might have seen?
"You killed a man in cold blood," Angelo said quietly. "But I won't name you if you let Ava go."
He willed Ava to stay silent. Captain von Essen did not need to know it was she who had seen him murder Aldo.
"You think anyone cares about the death of one Jew?"
Captain von Essen said, incredulous.
"This is what you bargain with."
"The war will end. Germany will lose, and you will answer for your sins,"
Angelo said, spitting the words through bloody lips.
"Let Ava go. I will testify on your behalf. The testimony of a priest will mean something. I will say you are a merciful man. You will be able to go back to Germany with your wife, unlike the others who will be punished for their war crimes."
Von Essen laughed.
"I don't know how you know about the Jew in the street, but clearly you were there, which makes me even more certain that Ava is not the only Jew you have assisted."
He leaned out the door once more, and two SS men entered the room seconds later.
"Take her back to her cell,"
von Essen told the soldier behind Ava. To the two new arrivals, he directed,
"And take the father away, too. Keep working him over until he talks. Make sure the girl can hear his pain."
It had been 36 hours since they'd been separated. 36 hours of Angelo being questioned and tortured. 36 hours of hell. Ava had heard him ask for a drink. He'd been given nothing. Instead, he'd been doused in ice water and deprived of sleep. She'd heard him cry out in pain, though she knew he tried not to, for her sake. They'd hurt him. They'd beat him. They'd threatened him with descriptions of what they'd do to her. But he never talked, beyond prayers and the quiet insistence that he had no information. On Friday, the guards started pulling men from their cells, clearing them out, Jew and non-Jew alike, leaving only Ava and two other Jewish women, sisters, who had been detained and were awaiting deportation on the next train. Ava heard the guards open Angelo's cell and tell him to get up. She rushed to her door and pressed her face to the glass, aching for a better look as they dragged Angelo past. His swollen and bruised face was hardly recognizable. But they hadn't taken his cassock, and his formerly white collar was splattered in blood. He turned for one last look, struggling to stay on his feet.
"Angelo!" she screamed. "Angelo!"
The two remaining guards elbowed each other and walked over to her cell. She moved away from the glass as they unlocked the door. But as soon as it was opened, she fought to see beyond them, desperate to know where Angelo was being taken. She was immediately pushed back, shoved hard enough to make her fall back against the adjacent wall.
"Come now, Fraulein. You mustn't carry on in this way. What will your Jewish friends think? Yes, they might think there is something going on between you and the priest."
One of them mimed prayer while pumping his hips lewdly.
"Go to hell,"
Eva spit out in German, her tears bottled up behind her shocked eyes, her head pounding with denial. Angelo hadn't just been dragged away. Surely she would see him again.
"Ah, so little Fraulein speaks German."
The officer sounded surprised.
"You speak German," the other said flatly. "Are you a German Jew?"
"Go to hell," she repeated.
He brought his face an inch from hers, his eyes cold and icy. Blue, the same color as Angelo's. But Angelo's eyes were like the sky, warm, clear, endless, beloved.
"I'm already there, madam. But unfortunately for you, this hell isn't quite as bad as where you will be going. And you will be going there soon."
"Good news, though,"
the other guard said with false levity.
"Your priest won't have to live without you. You know where they're taking him, don't you?"
She waited, knowing that they were going to enjoy telling her.
"He will be executed with all the others. 33 German police died yesterday from a bomb set by partisans on Via Rasella. 10 Italians would die for every policeman who was killed. Via Tasso isn't the only prison we emptied out. The prison at Regina Colli was emptied too. Every Jew, every partisan, every anti-fascist we could find. Now we're pulling civilians off the streets. 330 men. Next time, maybe the partisans will think twice about setting bombs."
"There won't be a next time for some of them,"
the other guard added.
"There won't be a next time for your priest. I hope you gave him something to remember you by."
Eva covered her head with her arms and sank to the floor, too despondent to listen any longer. She wasn't even aware when they left.
24 March, 1944. Angelo Bianco, my white angel. They have taken you, and I am lost. But we were both here, once. Eva Rosselli.
Chapter 21. Ardeatine Caves. They were lined up and counted, their hands linked behind their heads, and then they were loaded into trucks, just like the Jews on the morning of the October roundup, and taken south of the city to an old quarry not far from the storied catacombs that tourists came to see and Romans never thought about. There were no tourists in Rome these days, just Germans, beleaguered Italians, and the Catholic Church. Just war, hunger, hopelessness, and death. Angelo's ribs had been kicked a time too many, and one eye was swollen shut. He hadn't been able to see where they were taking them, riding in the back of the covered truck. But it hadn't taken overly long for them to arrive. When all 336 men, six more than was required, were herded from the trucks and lined up once more, he'd recognized his surroundings. His spirits had plummeted. It was the perfect setting for a massacre. The German guard kept them sufficiently contained with bound hands and intimidated with pointed guns. No one tried to escape. Why was that? Was hope so powerful that it would cause a man to cooperate to the very end? He'd seen it over and over again. So few people actually fought, because fighting seemed so futile. Fighting back meant certain death, so they all cooperated and hoped. The hope ended when the killing began inside the quarry. At that point, weeping and praying also commenced, and Angelo began dispensing comfort the only way he knew how. Amazingly enough, the German soldiers allowed him to administer rites, and they ignored his prayers and his movement up the line to reach those who would enter the caves first. With his hands bound behind his back, he couldn't properly make the sign of the cross, but he moved his right hand in the proper direction and continued on. He accompanied the second group of men into the quarry, winding through tunnels until they reached a large cave. He kept his mouth moving, administering last rites and hoping God would understand and forgive his own inadequacies and provide for these 335 souls who were looking to him, a fallen man who no longer wanted to be a priest. Five would kneel. Five executioners would press the noses of their guns to the backs of the prisoners' necks. Five triggers were pulled. Five men would die. Five more would then kneel behind the pile of the dead, only to share their fate. Each time, Angelo expected to be pushed forward and forced to his knees. And each time, he was bypassed and allowed to continue the rites for the men who were dying all around him. A boy and his father knelt side by side and were murdered side by side, their bodies falling into a sloppy embrace. And Angelo wept as he prayed. But he refused to close his eyes. He needed to see, to bear witness, even in his last moments, to what was occurring. The blood of the innocent demanded it. It took hours. When the pile of bodies grew too high, they would create another row until the cave was filled with the dead, and then they would move to another opening. Still, Angelo prayed, blessing those waiting to die. When the final man was thrown face first onto the blood-soaked mountain of death, would there be anyone left to die beside him? As the Germans neared what had to be the end, there was a brief lull as bodies were moved, and more men were led through the dark passageway. Suddenly, Angelo was being shoved from behind and urged to walk. When he resisted, he was grabbed by his bound arms and yanked forward. "Come with me, Father," a voice said. But he wasn't sure if the voice was in the caves or in his mind. His ears were ringing, the result of hundreds of gunshots, one after another, with nothing to protect his eardrums from the report. He staggered and fell down, his already poor balance compromised by his hearing loss. Rough hands jerked him to his feet, and he tottered again. His hands were suddenly cut free from his bindings, and his arms screamed in pain as the blood rushed through his limbs. He was urged forward again, the hand gripping his arm steadying him through a narrow passage that led to a tapered swath of light. The light grew, and the man leading him urged him on until he found himself crawling through a small opening, coming out of the cave about 150 feet east of the craggy main entrance where the prisoners had first formed the long line. He stopped and turned around, still not sure what was expected of him. He was on higher ground now, and could look down on a semicircle of helmeted, blood-soaked Germans that stood a ways off. Others, those who had guarded men awaiting execution, leaned against trucks that were now empty, smoking and drinking bottles of cognac. Cognac for courage. More than one officer had grown sick inside the caves, and others had refused to shoot, only to be dragged off or forced to participate by a commanding officer. The assembly of soldiers wasn't nearly as orderly and contained as it had been at the start, and no one had seen him or his unknown deliverer, who tugged on his arm once more and pointed through the trees. The German soldier had a blunt nose, a wholesome face, and red-rimmed eyes, and Angelo noticed there were blood splatters, small red pin-sized dots all over the soldier's cheeks. making him appear diseased. The soldier's mouth moved around words, and Angelo focused on their shape, trying to understand. He heard the words as if he listened through water, and he wondered if his hearing would return, or if it was simply the first part of him to die.
"Go. None of us wants to kill a priest," the man mouthed.
The soldier shoved Angelo away from the rocky outcropping and motioned with his pistol.
"Go,"
he growled, sticking his face in Angelo's, his eyes frantic. Angelo heard enough to realize he was being told to flee. He turned and began to put one foot in front of the other. His prosthetic straps were loose, and he staggered and almost fell. But he didn't dare stop and make the necessary adjustments, expecting a bullet in his back at any moment. But none came, and he kept walking, limping through the trees toward a road he knew must be there. The terrain was muddy and wet from recent rains, and the trees were just starting to grow leaves again. Some were still completely bare, as if the winter had been harder on them than on others. Angelo wondered, still reeling from shock and horror, if those trees would ever come back to life, or if they would simply stand, skeletal, among the living and wait to be brought down. He wondered if he would ever come back to life. Then he stopped thinking at all. He just walked in circles, stumbling and slipping. And after what could have been an hour or merely minutes, he wasn't really certain. He reached the road. A sign next to a fork pointed the way to the old quarries at Fosse Ardeatine. Suddenly, a boom rocked the ground beneath his feet. Angelo fell to the earth once more and lay there, reeling, wondering if bombs were falling. He couldn't hear the whine and shriek or see the stars and stripes above him in the sky. The ground rumbled again, then again, and the trees above him shook in whispery terror, their new leaves dancing in the tepid March sunlight. Then he realized what was happening. The Germans were using explosives to bring down the rocks inside the caves. They were trying to hide the bodies and seal the openings, attempting to cover their tracks, as if more than 300 people would not be missed. He crawled back into the shelter of the foliage that lined the road, weak with pain and horror, sick with despair, and waited until the trucks rumbled down the road an hour later, the deed done. Darkness descended, and his cane was gone. His cross, too. And Ava would be gone. The truth assailed him like a relentless whip, and he moaned audibly, his agony escaping through his clenched teeth.
"Save my family," Camillo had said.
"Become a priest and save my family."
But there was no one left to save. He didn't even know if he had the strength to save himself. Still, he rose on shaking legs and willed himself forward. It was a long way to Rome for a crippled man with a broken heart.
"He is dead. Father Bianco is dead. You realize that, don't you? You don't have to die. I will let you walk out of here. I will keep your little secret. But you need to tell me where he was hiding the fugitives," Captain von Essen said reasonably. Ava didn't even bother to look at him. He was an idiot. He'd left himself no real incentive, no bargaining chip. Didn't he realize that without Angelo she wanted to die? Didn't he realize she had absolutely nothing left to live for? With the gold file she kept in her shoe, she'd scratched his name into the wall of her cell, along with a date and a testimony that she'd been there. That he'd been there. But it was tedious, scratching the words into the walls. She wanted to write one last confession, even if no one but the captain ever read her words.
"I would like a piece of paper and a pencil," she said quietly. He jumped to his feet and walked to the door. He snapped his fingers and told someone what was needed. A soldier was back within seconds, and Captain von Essen set the paper and pencil down in front of her. He sat down and smiled, nodding his head like he was proud of her, certain she was finally cooperating. She put the date at the top, 24 March 1944, and she started to write in German.
Confession. My name is Bathsheba Rosselli, not Eva Bianco, and I am a Jew. Angelo Bianco is not my brother but a priest, who wanted only to protect me from the very place I now find myself.
She wrote for several minutes, filling the page with her final thoughts. When she was done, she slid her paper toward the captain and stared at him dully. He read with growing anger, not having received the confession he sought.
"You are going to die. Do you understand?"
he spat.
"We are all going to die, Captain, eventually. If I were you, I would kill me now, because if I live, I will tell the world who you are and what you've done,"
she answered, folding her hands.
"I will tell Greta that you are a vicious killer. But then I think Greta already knows what kind of man you are."
"Take her away. She's useless,"
Captain von Essen called to the guard. Then he stood and looked down at Eva.
"Enjoy your trip, Fraulein Bianco."
Eva flinched at the name. Angelo's name. She would never be Eva Bianco. She had almost felt relieved when she was arrested. The thing she had dreaded, feared, run from, had happened. When it came, she was strangely liberated from the fear. She couldn't dread what had already come to pass. She didn't have to anticipate the horror when the horror was right there. With her arrest came a certain calm, a quiet comfort. It had come. She had known it would, and she could stop fighting. But then they arrested Angelo, and they tortured him. When they dragged Angelo away, the comfort left and the fear came back.
Fear is strange. It settles on chests and seeps through skin, through layers of tissue, muscle, and bone, and collects in a soul-sized black hole, sucking the joy out of life, the pleasure, the beauty. But not the hope. Somehow, the hope is the only thing resistant to the fear. And it is that hope that makes the next breath possible, the next step, the next tiny act of rebellion, even if that rebellion is simply staying alive. When they told her Angelo was dead, she lost her hope.
"Help me, St. George,"
Angelo prayed, beseeching the statue overlooking the church fountain. It wasn't St. George, but it could have been. Maybe it was St. Jude, the patron saint of lost causes, the apostle of the impossible. If so, Angelo had a task for him.
"Help me to face what is to come,"
he murmured through lips that wouldn't cooperate.
"Help me get to Rome, and most of all, watch over Eva. Take care of Eva until I can do it myself."
He'd filled his belly with brackish water from the fountain and washed himself as best he could, trying not to think of the blood and death he carried on his skin and in his clothes. Then he turned and stumbled away from the fountain of the unknown saint and continued his painful slog toward Rome. He needed to reach Santa Cecilia before dawn. He had to find Eva. Hours later, when he limped the final steps and collapsed against the gates of the convent, the church bells began to ring, but Angelo was too far gone to notice. Eva was still wearing the gray dress she'd worn to work on Wednesday, still wearing her low-heeled black shoes and her little black belt. She was stylishly filthy. Her hair was matted. It hadn't been brushed and... she thought back, days? How many days? Wednesday she had been arrested. Friday they had dragged Angelo away. Saturday morning she was loaded on a train. It was still Saturday, and she still sat in the stinking darkness of the cattle car, the press of bodies keeping her warm, but making her want to climb up to the little window that sat high on the side,
just so she could breathe air that hadn't been breathed 100 times and see a stretch of sky. There were only women and children in this car. The Jewish man detained in the prisons had been taken to help satisfy the numbers required for the reprisal killing. Just like Angelo. 4 days. It had been 4 days since she'd brushed her hair, or her teeth, or looked in a mirror. She had a strange feeling that if she saw herself, she wouldn't recognize her face. 7 days ago, she'd lain in Angelo's arms, the happiest she'd ever been in her entire life. Now she sat Shiva over her old life in a train that would take her to her death. She managed to find a place against the wall. They designated a corner for waste, and though no one wanted to use it, they all eventually had. The humiliation of the older women especially, crouched in that corner, trying to maintain their modesty while not stepping in the waste of others. Tears of mortification streaming down their faces was something she didn't think she could ever forgive. It is one thing to kill someone. It is another to degrade and humiliate, to strip away a person's dignity like stripping away flesh. One made man a murderer. The other made him a monster. Eva was sure many of the women aboard that train would prefer death, clean and quick, to the slow loss of their humanity. They were on the train for hours. It stopped once and they could hear dogs and commands, the sounds of more people being loaded into the cattle cars. But the doors were never reopened. Eva thought they were in Florence. It smelled like Florence. Like home, and she pressed her palms to her eyes, trying not to weep and call out for nonna and nonno like a child. She couldn't afford to cry. She was too thirsty. It was the end of March and the temperatures were moderate. It could have been so much worse. But it was hard to tell yourself how much more terrible a situation could be when you were already on the outskirts of hell. The hungry children suffered the most. Or maybe that wasn't true. When children suffer, the ones who love them suffer even more, helpless to alleviate their agony. When the train started to move for the second time, the occupants almost wept in relief, just to be leaving one torture for another, and Eva sank down, pulling her knees to her chest so she wouldn't take up too much space, and rested her head against the side of the car. She had slept deeply that first night of confinement, waiting for the train that would take her away from her life, from the struggle, from everything that had become so impossibly hard. Now she slept deeply again, an ability she'd always had, and in sleep she escaped for a while. She recognized the dream immediately. It was the dream she'd had 100 times before. But confusion welled up inside her chest. Was she dreaming? The press of bodies in the darkness felt real. She remembered being loaded into the car, a German with a submachine gun pushing at her back. This wasn't a dream, but she'd been here before. They didn't veer northeast toward the Brenner Pass, with Austria lying on the other side, but instead hugged the west coast and approached France. They spent a week at a transit camp called Borgo San Dalmazzo in the Piedmont region of Italy, 20 miles from the French border, where they were fed, thin soup and hard bread, and given enough water to wash and quench their thirst. The knowledge that they had been heading west instead of east was a great relief, though they would be heading due north from that point on, if the reports were true.
"Bergen-Belsen! We're going to Bergen-Belsen!" a woman cried, a thankful smile on her lips.
She even closed her eyes and raised her hands to heaven, offering a prayer of gratitude at the development. They weren't going to Auschwitz, and many of the women felt that was cause for celebration. It was strange how rumors started, trickling down from one mouth to another, crossing great distances to comfort or console,
taunt or terrify. Bergen-Belsen wasn't as bad as Auschwitz. Survival was possible. Families could even live together. Sometimes the prisoners were given a little milk and cheese to eat. That's what the rumors were. Those were the tales some of the women had heard. But Bergen-Belsen was in Germany. Northern Germany, someone else said fearfully, as if Poland were preferable to Germany. Germany meant Hitler.
They sent the Libyan Jews that were hiding in Italy to Bergen-Belsen last fall, someone else offered. Everyone else in Italy has gone to Auschwitz. We are so lucky.
So lucky. They might die more slowly, suffer longer. She just wanted it to be done. Bergen-Belsen sounded like death by a slow drip. Auschwitz was the 6 a.m. rapido to the great beyond. She thought she might prefer that. Eva was distantly alarmed by her readiness to die, but only distantly.
When Angelo woke again, Mario Sonnino sat by his bed reading, the lamp casting odd shadows around the humble space.
He had given Angelo something. Morphine, he guessed. Angelo had been in and out of consciousness, waking only to beg for news of Eva, and then falling back into oblivion before he could get any answers. But he knew she was gone. Mario said no one knew for sure, but Monsignor O'Flaherty said a train filled with Jewish women and children had left Tiburtina station on Saturday. He wished for oblivion again, but knew those hours were behind him. He was wide awake, and Mario helped him sit up so he could swing his legs. His prosthetic had been removed, over the side and used the chamber pot. Hopping down the hallway was out of the question, and he was too sore for crutches. He finished and managed to eat some cold polenta and brown bread and drink a glass of water before easing himself back down on the pillow. Mario hovered for a moment, clearly wanting to be of assistance.
"Hey, sit your finger and bend your ribs. They're cracked but not broken. You're black and blue, but the swelling's gone down. I put your nose back where it belongs. How are your eyes? I worried a little about your sight in the right one."
"I can see," Angelo said. "I'll be fine."
"Yes, yes you will. The ribs will take the longest, but no long-term damage done. Your fingernails might not grow back."
"I'm not worried about my fingernails," Angelo said, his eyes bleak.
"No," Mario murmured. "I don't suppose you are."
He sat down heavily in his chair.
"I have to find her, Mario."
Mario swallowed, his throat working against the heavy emotion in the room.
"How?"
he whispered.
"I don't know."
Angelo's voice broke, and he put his hands over his face the way he did when he prayed. But there was no solace in his hands. No solace in prayer. Not anymore.
"The Americans are coming. We just needed to hold on a little longer. I just needed to keep her safe a little longer. I have been such a fool. I should have married her in 1939. I could have taken her away, back to America, like her father suggested."
"We all had opportunities to escape.
We all had those inner voices that said, flee, leave.
Those things have haunted me too, Angelo," Mario said, rubbing hard at the back of his neck, fighting the old regrets, the guilt that had kept him up so many nights.
"Eva told me once that the roots of the Jewish people are in their traditions, in their children and in their families. She asked me why the Catholic Church wants to take a man and deprive him of his posterity. She told me there would be no more Angelo Biancos. My roots would die with me."
Angelo was so overcome he could hardly speak, but he was desperate to get the words out.
"I am a man who was so impressed by the thought of immortality, of being a martyr or a saint, that I didn't realize that by becoming a priest I was depriving myself of the very thing I sought. Our immortality comes through our children and their children, through our roots and our branches. The family is immortality. And Hitler has destroyed not just branches and roots, but entire family trees, forests, all of them, gone. Eva was the only Rosselli left, the only Adler left.
The terrible reality of his words silenced them momentarily, and they bowed their heads, shoulders hunched against the weight of such heavy truth, such staggering loss. And it took a concerted effort for Mario to respond.
You have saved and preserved so many branches, Angelo,
he said in a choked whisper.
You saved my family. Eva saved my family, and we will never forget her. We will never forget you. I will tell my children, and they will tell their children. You might not have children who will carry your names, but you will have branches and roots who will honor your names.
Mario wept, and Angelo reached out a hand, thanking him, even as his heart rejected his sentiments. It wasn't enough. He didn't want honor. He didn't want to be a hero. He just wanted Eva, and she had been taken from him. The thing he had feared most had come to pass.
She loved you,
Mario said. It was not a question. And Angelo wondered if everyone around them could see all along what he'd refused to admit.
Yes, and I love her.
He refused to put it in past tense. He would never stop loving her.
Did she know, Angelo? Did she know you loved her?
Mario asked gently.
Yes.
Angelo wiped at his face, at the tears that wouldn't stop falling. She'd known. He'd been able to tell her, to show her. It was the one thing he was grateful for. And in his heart he acknowledged the blessing he'd been given. Mario stood and walked to the small chest of drawers in the corner. There was a pile of books placed neatly on top. Angelo recognized them immediately. Eva's journals.
These are hers. There are several of them. They all look the same, but you can see that she's dated them over the years. You should have them.
He set them on the bed, near Angelo, and quietly left the room. There were four books, all identical. The only differences were in the slight wear on the covers, the dates at the top of each page, and the handwriting that slowly changed and matured. Just like the girl herself. But the last book was only half filled, and Angelo found he couldn't look at the empty pages. The empty pages hurt worse than seeing the crowded lines filled with Eva's thoughts, because in the words she lived, the emptiness mocked him with what could have been, what should have been. He flipped to the last entry and read it just to escape the unfinished chapters.
22nd March, 1944. Confession. Kissing Angelo is a mitzvah. My Jewish grandmother would roll in her grave if I said it out loud. Uncle Augusto would accuse me of sacrilege. But it's true. In him I have found a slice of the divine, a morsel of peace. And when his lips are on mine, his hands on my skin, there is reason to believe that life is more than pain, more than fear, more than sorrow. I am hopeful for the first time in years. And strangely enough, I find myself convinced that God loves his children, all his children, that he loves me, and that he provides moments of light and transcendence amid the constant trial.
Angelo closed the book and wept.
Chapter 22.
Nowhere. When they were loaded aboard the train again, a week after arriving at Borgo San Dalmazzo, The numbers had grown to include men, women, and children from other places, who had all been brought to the transit camp. There were 20 cars, with about 100 Jews loaded aboard each car. Many of the people were there with members of their families, and they clamored to stay together. Ava was alone, so she just let herself be pushed and pinched, as people far more desperate than she clung to each other and fought for better positions. She found a corner and slid down against the wall like she'd done on the first leg of the trip, letting herself drift up and away to numb blindness. It was too dark to try and see anyway. She curled into herself, fighting to stay asleep, to stay oblivious, and she caught a whiff of tobacco, a wisp of smoke, and she raised her head, wanting to breathe it in. He was there, next to her, looking exactly as he had the last time she saw him. His pipe glowed in the darkness, and his long legs were stretched out in front of him, like he had all the room in the world. In his hand, he had a glass of wine. The wine was dark, and it glimmered like an enormous gemstone cradled in the palm of his hand. She was so thirsty.
Babo?
Ava asked, her voice high and childlike in her head.
Batsheva,
her father said, smiling and swirling his wine. But the smile faded quickly.
Ava, why are you sleeping?
He chided.
What else can I do?
You can fight. You can live.
I don't want to fight, Babo. I want to be with you. I want to be with you and Uncle Felix and Uncle Augusto. I want to be with Claudia and Levi.
You want to be with Angelo, he finished gently. Most of all, you want to be with Angelo.
Yes, I do. Is he there? With you?
She would give anything to see him.
No, Babo shook his head. He is not with me. He is there, with you.
Where? I am on a train. I am being taken away.
Her father touched her face. She could feel his hand, long-fingered and light against her cheek.
Angelo is inside you. His flesh is now your flesh. His branch is your branch.
No, they killed him. They have killed everyone. And they will kill me, too.
Ava, listen to me. All your life you have had a dream of this moment. You know that, don't you? You recognize the dream.
Ava nodded, and the fear returned like a deluge, flooding her veins and turning her fingers to ice.
You have to jump, Ava.
I can't.
You can. What do you have to do first?
I have to climb to the window.
She didn't think she could fit through that opening, and there were bars dividing it. She couldn't remove the bars.
You climb up to the window. And then what? In the dream, what did you do next?
I breathed in the cold air.
Yes, you breathe and gather courage. And then what?
She shook her head stubbornly. Resisting. She remembered that wicked relief, that sweet poison of letting go, of giving up. It had released her, temporarily, and she wasn't ready to care again.
I don't think I can do it. I don't want to. I'm so tired, and I'm so alone.
But you must do it. You are the last Roselli. You must jump, Batsheva. Because if you don't, you will surely die. And Angelo will die, too.
Angelo is already dead.
You must jump, Ava. You must jump. And you must live.
He whispered, his breath a kiss on her wet cheek. He was so real. Just like the dream that was no longer a dream. When Ava woke, her father was gone, and her brief respite from trying was over. In the morning, sore but able to get around, Angelo packed the books in the small valise Eva had brought with her to Rome. He folded her clothes and put them in the bigger suitcase, clearing out the room because he couldn't stand for anyone else to touch her things. He made her bed, folding the covers neatly, even though he knew one of the sisters would strip them off when he left and wash them. He wanted to take the case that covered the pillow, and ended up folding it and tucking it inside the valise, unable to part with the physical reminder of her scent merged with his. He couldn't manage to summon any guilt for taking something that wasn't his. He'd already taken something that wasn't his, and she'd instantly been taken away from him. He started to shake, the grief and disbelief making him wonder how he was ever going to go on. Movement hurt, thought hurt, breathing hurt, and none of it was because of his battered body. He welcomed that pain because it distracted him. He made himself walk down the stairs, juggling Eva's things. Mother Francesca saw him and rushed to his side, scolding him fiercely and trying to remove the cases from his arms. "What do you think you're doing? You have to rest, at least for a few more days," she clucked. "I've been in bed for 3 days. That's enough rest," he answered softly. "I will take these things home."
"You can't go home. Monsignor Luciano came here. He delivered some of your things. You are to stay hidden until the Americans arrive. If everyone thinks you're dead, they won't be looking for you. You'll be safe as long as you stay here and stay out of sight. He said Monsignor O'Flaherty has been conducting all of his meetings on the steps of St. Peter's to avoid arrest. When he leaves the Vatican, he has to wear a disguise. There have been attempts to grab him right off the street. Someone even tried to pull him across the white line the Germans drew on the ground. If they pull him across, he is no longer under Vatican protection and can be arrested. Someone got wind of the plan and turned the tables. The man hired to kidnap the Monsignor got a good pounding." Mother Francesca's eyes were bright and her cheeks flushed, and Angelo found himself smiling slightly at her obvious excitement over the pounding. She'd had more excitement in the last few months than she'd probably ever had in her whole life and would ever have again. But the news put a wrench in his plans. He couldn't sit in Eva's room and wait for the war to be over. If he didn't keep working, keep moving, he wouldn't survive. He would be the next casualty of war's hopelessness. He would be the one walking in front of the streetcar, or throwing himself from a bridge, or inciting a German to shoot him. He felt it in the black despair that coiled in his stomach, threatening to strike, to sink its venomous teeth into his chest and stop his heart. There was work to be done, and he was going to do it. He would just take a page from O'Flaherty's playbook. "The best way to hide," Eva had said, "was not to hide at all." Angelo pulled on a worn pair of trousers and a work shirt that he still had from his time in the hillside parish. Priests were required to wear a cassock when they left their homes, but there had been plenty of work to do inside the crumbling rectory and the ancient church, and he'd worn out a pair of trousers and several shirts in the process. He removed his prosthetic and pinned up the trouser leg, so that it was obvious to anyone looking at him that it was missing. Monsignor Luciano had delivered his crutches with his possessions, and with his sleeves rolled, a cigarette hanging from his lip, 3 days' growth on his jaw, and a worn-out black cap, he looked like a young soldier, aged by war and injury, who had paid his dues and asked only to be left alone. He would draw attention, and it would be met with either sympathy or a quick averting of the eyes. The Germans might ask for his papers, and he had some he could use, but more likely he would be ignored. He put his cassock and his cross and a change of clothes in his satchel and looped it over his back, stuffing his real pass in one pocket and his fake pass in the other. He'd need the real one to get into the Vatican. The majority of the Jews in the cattle car spoke French. French had been required in school, but Eva was rusty,
and she had to listen closely to understand. But she didn't need to speak fluent French to know what the man named Armand was attempting. He'd climbed up the side of the